The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Beth Macy. She joins us on the telephone in Roanoke, Virginia. Hello, Beth.
Hey, Vic. It's so great to be back.
Beth, I'm excited because your book, True Vine, just came out in paperback, and we wanted to have you back on the show because you're coming back through the area, and I think we need to tell our audience about this incredible book because it's one of the most interesting books I've read in years. It's called True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South. How did you get the idea for this? Wasn't it from Facebook?
Yeah, I had the idea to write a book like in 2013 from a Facebook posting that just let me know that the subject of George and Willie Mews was really popular, but I'd actually gotten the idea to write about them 25 years before, back when I was a young newspaper reporter and had stumbled onto it, just doing some reporting on some other stories.
And the Mews brothers, who were they?
So George and Willie Mews were two African-American brothers born into a sharecropping family in rural Virginia around 1900. And their family, you know, did that awful sharecropping tobacco farming work where often, you know, their labors would go unpaid. And it was pretty tough work, especially for people who were born with albinism and couldn't really be in the sun. And the story that was told to me was that they had been kidnapped by a circus bounty hunter around the ages of 6 and 9.
And then they were forced to perform in circuses for many, many years. And these were just little kids who, were they abducted? How did this happen? Did you ever figure that out?
Well, there is still some question about it. The family maintains, as Willie Mews himself maintained throughout his whole long and storied life, that their initial manager kidnapped them, and then I was able to confirm that they were trafficked, that is, forced to work without pay for a period of at least 13 years. There's some question, there's some suggestion in some of the media reports from the early years that perhaps the mother initially let them go, presumably for pay. But that is not something the family has ever agreed with. And there's plenty of suggestion about those white mainstream media reports that would suggest that the media got it wrong. So I think it's one of those great unknowables. And I like to defer to Willie, who, even though the brothers were written about hundreds of times over the years, he was never once interviewed.
Even though he lived to be 108 years old.
Yeah, and even though when their mother finally gets him back in 1927, the story is carried all over the country, in fact, worldwide, because one of the things that we forget, I think, with our phones and just this media around us 24/7 is just what a huge deal the circus was. I mean, the circus back between 1840 and 1940 was the number one form of entertainment in America. So that's before TV, radio was big, movies, before professional sports was big. I mean, it was the second day after Christmas Day in order of importance, and people didn't take big vacations like they do now, and they would just, you know, they would save their money so that they could go to the circus when the circus came to town. And so they were stars of that time. They were forced to appear in the sideshow. They played music. They were exhibited because they were albino, and that was thought to be kind of this strange and scientifically curious thing, according to their sideshow promoters, but it was really just another way to get a separate admission fee out of the patron.
Oh, So that was separate from the circus to go to the freak show.
Yeah, yeah, it was like another quarter they dinged you for on your way in. And
I see.
Thought to be this kind of, you know, slightly naughty thing, but it was also, especially in the early years, it was couched as this will help educate you about people from all over the world. And, you know, of course, the brothers were trafficked as being savages from Ecuador and found floating on a raft off the coast of Madagascar that was said to be found by John Ringling himself. And then the biggest, one of their most popular stage names and stories was that they had been found coming out of a spaceship that had crashed in the Mojave Desert. And at that point, they're nicknamed Eco and Ico, the ambassadors from Mars.
Mm-hmm. You quote a guy who was the longtime announcer and freak show impresario for Ringling Brothers Circus, Lou Graham, who said that the three basic rules for a freak act were, quote, the abnormality must be remarkable, if possible, unique. It must be exploitable by an accompanying talent or dexterity, and it must be inoffensive to public taste. And what was it about these two young boys that attracted the freak show hunters? I mean, what was it that was distinctive about them?
Yeah, well, it was really just their albinism. So they had very light skin, but they had African-American features, blue eyes, golden hair. And so they would take those attributes and they would kind of underscore them by, for instance, growing their hair into these long dreadlocks, which were very unusual at the time. People, unlike today when we see dreadlocks all the time, people didn't really thought that was, oh, maybe they did find them in the jungles of Africa or something, because they'd never seen it before. And then they would even emphasize that by sort of drawing their dreadlocks up into kind of a configuration that looked like they had sparklers made of hair coming from the crowns of their heads. And then they would dress them in these kind of outlandish costumes that sort of, they thought, emphasized their exoticness.
And you have lots of photos in True Vine, including a number of photos of the brothers.
That's kind of an interesting point about the photos, because especially when I found that very first photo of them where they're clearly being trafficked as children. You know, they look young and scared in the picture. It's the first known photo of them from around 1914. And so, that, I mean, that was some of the best, most solid evidence that of what their lives were like then. And I would send the photos off to costume experts and they would tell me what they saw in them, which was a lot more than I can see in them.
Beth Macy joins us. Her book, True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping and a Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South, just out in paperback. And she will be in Dayton for a book signing this afternoon out in Beaver Creek at the Green, 2 o'clock this afternoon, November 19th. You can meet her. She'll be talking about True Vine and autographing copies of the book for those who attend. And telling the story of George and Willie Muse, who were put in the circus at a young age, and we picture their fear and their terror and their insecurity and their loneliness, and we hear about how they were told over and over again when they would cry, your mother is dead.
Yeah, quit crying. Your mother is dead. And, you know, of course, they were never allowed to go to school, so they never learned how to read. And, you know, the book relays in all of its glory and drama the moment when they found out their mother was not dead, which is one of my favorite parts of the book, because here she is, Harriet Muse, an illiterate maid, going into the sideshow tent, not standing in the back where she's supposed to be standing with all the other African-Americans, but making her way up to the front and demanding that Ringling give her children back. It was quite astonishing.
What a dramatic moment. They actually brought the circus with her two sons to Roanoke, and we just we picture it. Now, is this? Did I hear a rumor that this is going to be turned into a movie?
Yeah, it's been optioned by Leonardo DiCaprio's production company, working with Paramount Pictures, and he wants to play the kidnapper. You were just going to say, I think that what a dramatic moment that would be in the movie, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, it's one of the most dramatic moments that I've heard described in a book in a long time. Are you saying that Leonardo, if they make the film, would be Candy Shelton?
Yeah, and so you can imagine him being right there, not wanting to give him up. At one point in the exchange, there, Candy Shelton says, these are my children, not hers. And she says back to them, can't no white man birth no colored children? I mean, that's according to the press accounts, you know, it's a story that was on the front page for days and went national. And Ringling's lawyer showed up, didn't want to give him back. And she ends up taking them home. She doesn't get arrested, even though the Commonwealth attorney, the top prosecutor in town, is the founder of the local KKK, which is the largest Klan in the state at the time. And just a couple of weeks prior to her getting him back, on the same fairground spot, was a huge KKK rally. So when I put all that into context, or when I started to figure it out just by reading who he was and understanding what had gone on that ground, I realized it was just almost suicidally bold of Harriet Muse that day.
All right, so the mother reclaims her children, and they all lived happily ever after. Not.
Not. Yep. So the next astonishing thing she did after she got them back was she filed a lawsuit right away, like 2 days later, against the Greatest Show on Earth, and with the help of an ambitious, brash young lawyer, and ends up, over the course of the next several months, getting a settlement for their back pay, and then their stepfather basically absconds with it, and there they are in a fix again. And here they are, still in Roanoke, Virginia, sort of being ogled by everyone in a land they don't really know anymore. Somebody who remembered that time, he was a young boy at the time, told me he remembered seeing them be displayed in the downtown window of a drugstore, and just that they looked really sad. And even though the gentleman who remembered that was a distant relative of the family, he remembered being scared of them at the time, too. So they really were kind of ostracized by blacks and whites alike.
My guest is Beth Macy. Beth, you've had a long career as a journalist and as a reporter, and now you're writing these wonderful books. And you really had a big obstacle in doing the research for this. You alluded to the fact that when you were still working for the newspaper, that you tried to look into the story. In fact, you had a colleague who had a lot of notes that she saved on this reporting. And you had a relative of the Muse brothers who was very protective of them, and your biggest obstacle was just trying to get her to talk to you, to give you some approval for your project, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the first time I asked if I could do a story on her uncles, she ran a little soul food restaurant in town called the Goody Shop, and it was one of these amazing places where there was no menu. You were just supposed to know that Monday was spaghetti, Tuesday was pork chops. You didn't want to ask. You just had to know. And she opened when she got there. So often you drive by and there'd be a big line. And I had been told that it was the best store in town, but nobody had been able to get it because she didn't trust anybody at the white-run newspaper to tell it because they hadn't told it very well the first time, you know, in 1927. So when I go in 1989 or early 90s, actually, I had been a reporter just here for just a couple of years, and I asked to do the story. She pointed to a sign on the wall that one of her customers had made with a stencil, and the sign said, and it really captured the essence of Nancy, the sign said, sit down and shut up. And so basically, no, hell no. Mm-hmm. He's retired. The older brother had passed away in the 70s, but Willie Mays was still alive in his 90s. And as she put it, he's been exploited his whole life. You're not going to be one more white person stirring up crap in his world. Mm. So she told me to go away. So I just hung out at the restaurant. And eventually she let me do a piece on a restaurant, which she wasn't all that thrilled about, because she said, you know what your story did? It brought out a bunch of crazy white people, that's all. And so we developed this kind of funny banter, and she actually becomes a really good source of mine over the years, helping me with other stories. And at a time in journalism when the Roanoke Times, a paper that had been really harsh to black families for decades, you know, editorially cheering when 1,600 black-owned homes were demolished in the name of progress, a.k.a. urban renewal, which the black community called Negro removal. I mean, this is why she didn't trust me, and rightly she didn't trust me. But at the time when I was a young reporter, you know, we were really trying to make up for what had gone on and doing feature articles about African Americans, not just stories when they were in trouble, which had been the thing for so long. Mm-hmm. And so she really helped me get to know my community in a way that reporters should have been knowing their communities all along. I mean, I'm really grateful to her. She's helped me with numerous stories over the years. Still, when I asked if I could turn the stories about George and Willie that I had written for the Roanoke Times after Willie's death in 01, I asked if I could do a book 13 years later. You know, she had to think about it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
6 weeks, she made me wait.
You are listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. My guest in the Book Nook today is Beth Macy. Her book, True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South, has just come out in paperback. And Beth, I've got to have you talk about what their performances were like. I'm sure our listeners are trying to imagine, well, what was it that they did? Did they just stand there? They developed some amazing talents, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did. So initially, according to the photos, it looked like they pretty much just stood there looking scared and, you know, exhibiting the fact that they were albinos, which was unusual. By the time they're 15, 16, they're playing instruments. They're holding instruments in the photographs. And that was something that they were quite good at. It was said by all accounts that they could hear a song one time and play it on almost any instrument. George and Willie played songs, pop songs of the day, typically. One of Nancy's favorite songs that Willie would sing to her, even, you know, when he was 100 years old, he would sing to her the song, You Are My Sunshine, and that was their special song. One of the songs I love the most, and it's the song that it was said that they were playing when they first caught glimpse of their mother after 13 years, was a song from World War One, called It's a Long Way to Tipperary, an Irish war anthem about missing home. And Willie was said to, you know, be so sad about missing his mother, and the older brother George would sing him the song at night and say, you know, I know she's not dead. She's going to come back for us. And this is a song that just became really important to them.
Well, it's such a beautiful, sentimental song. Okay, they were discovered by their mother and returned back to their mother, and then the next chapter begins. They go back on the road, but this time they are supposedly not enslaved. Supposedly they are earning an income, but this was very unpredictable, wasn't it?
It seems from the documents that Ringling Brothers did pay them once they were under contract the following year. But whenever their manager could manage to slide them off to another outfit, like during the off season, or eventually he just went with a different circus altogether, whenever he could manage to get them away from Ringling and get them with another less, you know, willing to adhere to the deal outfit, he would. And so by 1936, Harriet Music gets fed up again. It's, you know, the Depression's raging, and it's hard. You know, if you saw the house where the family lived, I mean, it was, they were really struggling. No running water, a little shack that was eight people and 517 square feet. And so you see she finds another lawyer to file another lawsuit to get guardianship for them, which basically ends up putting into place, anytime the check doesn't come home or the check does come home and it bounces, a system wherein the brothers are tracked down, sometimes by Pinkerton detectives or missing detectives persons. And this guy who I call the heavy in the story, who's kind of the assistant of the lawyer, goes and makes the circus pay. And that's pretty astonishing, too, when you think about it. And they actually got a restraining order out against Candy Shelton finally in 1938. And at that point, the brothers don't see him again.
Hmm. Beth Macy joins us, and you can meet her this afternoon. She'll be at Books & Company at 2 o'clock for a book signing for the paperback release of True Vine. And that's at The Green in Beaver Creek, 2 o'clock this afternoon. She'll be talking about the book. And I imagine you'll be talking a little bit about your first book, and I'm hoping maybe you'll talk a little bit about your book that's going to be coming out next year. Can we talk a little bit about Factory Man first?
Sure.
That was your first book. What a book.
Oh, thanks, buddy. It came out in 14. It's a true story about a third-generation furniture maker who sued China in a court of international trade to keep his factory going. And of course, he's this great Faulknerian, almost, character who is, you couldn't make him up. You know, what a privilege it was to get to tell that story, because I always say it's like the book you can give your mom, who maybe lives in one of these dying factory towns and doesn't really understand, like many of us, I didn't, I know, why it is so many of these communities, their economy has collapsed. And the book sort of walks you through how that came to be through the story of somebody who fought back against it.
I guess I should footnote that by mentioning, Beth, that you grew up in Urbana, Ohio, and your mom worked at a factory that manufactured aircraft parts, right?
Yeah, Grimes Manufacturing. And much like the people in the book, I mean, I really set off not to tell this great heroic story, but I started doing my original reporting on the aftermath of globalization by going down to this one particular community that had the highest unemployment rate in the state for a decade, and really set out to tell the story of what happened to all the people that were left behind, who would do things like give me their cell phone numbers, but then say, oh, I better give you my mom's too, because my phone's going to be cut off. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of when my own mom would get laid off, and she would have to pick up under the table jobs, just like they were doing, you know, waitressing or babysitting. And you know, hearing my mom worry that, you know, maybe they were going to cut our gas off, our heat.
Uh-huh.
That was scary.
Well, Beth, I remember when we had you on for the hardcover publication of True Vine, and you mentioned that you were working on your next project. And I heard a rumor that you've written this book now, and it's going to be out in the coming year. This sounds like a very intense project. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. The working title is Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Makers That Addicted America. And I think of it as a kind of Factory Man Part 2. It is about the opioid crisis. I started reporting on heroin when it became apparent that it had really hit kind of the upper middle class suburbs of Roanoke, where I live, in 2012. A couple big stories made the news, and I followed up on them, and I continued to follow these families. One of the things I maybe didn't follow up on, and I should have, is when I was down reporting on Factory Man in Martinsville and Henry County. I mean, a lot of the crime was property crime. I mean, I don't know if you remember from Factory Man, like, one of the old Bassett furniture factories gets burned down by somebody who's trying to rip out copper electrical wiring that he can sell on the black market. you know, full stop, I should have gone on to say, because he was addicted to opioids and, you know, was going to be really sick if he didn't figure out a way to get his OxyContin or his heroin. Of course, around that same time, the OxyContin pills and the other opioid pills get harder to get, and the dealers start bringing in heroin, and that's, you know, basically the same morphine molecule based drug, and that's what you see now, only with much more harsher additives like fentanyl or carfentanil added. And I know you all have had a bad spike of overdose deaths where you are in the Dayton area in Springfield.
Yeah. Were there any particular communities that you focused on in Dope Sick?
Yeah, good question. I tell the story of the epidemic as I witnessed it landing in three communities in Virginia that I think sort of stand in for different kinds of kind of everywhere in America. So I start with the introduction of OxyContin in 1996, and one of the first places where it popped up as a huge problem was Lee County, Virginia, which is a coalfield county. It's the furthest west county in Virginia, and it just devastated that community. And one of the ways I could stand to do all this reporting, this is so dark and depressing, is by sort of highlighting the people who fought back in each of these three communities. Mm. So in the late 90s, fighting back against Purdue Pharma was this country doctor and an octogenarian nun who were calling them on the phone saying, I know your insert says it's not addictive, but we have high schoolers overdosing in the library. And so I follow that story kind of through the government's case against Purdue, which settles in 07, also in that same region. And then I go to Roanoke, where it lands in a suburb called Hidden Valley, ironically, because it was so hidden by the parents in this upper middle class community that didn't want others to know. And also the kids themselves could hide it, right, because they had money and resources to do so. And then more recently, heroin has landed in a little small town, kind of farming community up in the northern Shenandoah Valley. And that story really called to me because it was sort of the anatomy of the epidemic in miniature. And you could chart in this one small town called Woodstock, Virginia, the presence of a twice convicted drug dealer who comes to town. And in the course of just a month, the town goes from having four or five known heroin users to hundreds almost overnight. And the hero in that community is some local cops and an ATF agent who basically put their foot down and say, not in our town. And so, you know, that's kind of a hero story, too. In Roanoke, the people I'm featuring are mothers of children who died of heroin and pill overdose deaths, who are now leading a program to divert people from jail and into treatment. It's called the Hope Initiative, and that's pretty inspiring. But also, you know, it's just a tough thing to get people who are in active addiction, even if you finally line them up a treatment bed or some medication-assisted treatment, often that fear of being sick, which is what keeps people continuing to do these drugs, is that they get almost deathly ill when they stop. That fear of dope sickness just keeps them from getting help and keeps them from getting treatment.
We will watch for Dope Sick in 2018. Beth, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Vic. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
You can meet Beth Macy this afternoon. She will be at Books and Company in the Green in Beaver Creek at 2 o'clock on today, November 19th, for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.